Trigger warning. This episode contains discussion of sexual assault. Please be gentle with yourself when listening.
The way I was raised and the way I think is you work really hard to something and there's a positive outcome at the end of it, right?
Yeah.
You're like, I have worked on this book for all this time. I've been writing all this time. You know, like at the end of this rainbow is supposed to be an agent and a book deal. Mm-hmm. And it didn't happen. And I did not know how to process that.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Tara Shelton Harris, author of the novel One Summer in Savannah, a book about a woman who finds healing after something horrific.
A very close friend of mine shared something with me that I did not know, that she had conceived a child through sexual assault. And she said these words, and I say this anytime I give any talks, because this is what I remember the most about our conversation, that she said, and I practice the act of forgiveness every day.
Using the act of forgiveness as a theme was Tara's North Star while writing One Summer in Savannah, a book she started after she quit writing for 6 years. Why she gave up on the dream she's had since the sixth grade, plus how complacency motivates her ambitious nature, and what she says is her niche in which all of her other books will follow. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. Tara, when did you know that you were a writer?
In the sixth grade, I had a sixth grade teacher named Julie Cook, who we, back then, I don't want to age myself, but back then, there was a program in schools called Drop Everything and Read. It was known as DEAR. And of course I would read because I've been a reader my whole entire life, but I would write during that time too. Mm. And so she allowed me to write. I don't even remember what I was writing in particular. I just had this, I felt this really strong urge to write because I would read so much and I would always think, well, I want to write. And she really encouraged me to write. And then like one day she saw that I wasn't writing anymore. And she was like, oh, you know, you're not writing. She said, encourage that. Keep going with that until it just burns out. Mm. And I kept writing. And she, one day she said, do you want to read your story to the class? And it was a story about my class. And it was called The Class Party. And she let me read it. And they laughed. Like they were like really enjoying what I was reading. And I realized then, right then, that, wow, something that I wrote had an impact on people. And so I thought, I'm going to keep going with this until, as she said, until it burns out. And you know what? It never burned out.
So what did your family say when you said that you were a writer?
Well, see, my mother had, I have the best mother in the world, and I'll fight anybody that tells me I don't, but she's always encouraged us. We're a very artsy family. My mother is a writer. My brother is a writer. My older brother is an artist. He can draw. So that's our brain. That's our side of the brain. My mother always encouraged us to do whatever we felt like our heart was desired. But the problem is it was always, how are you going to make money doing that? You know, it was like, okay, you can write, but understand that you got to make money. So how can you do this? And so I thought I was going to be a journalist. Mm. I went to the University of Arkansas, majored in journalism, and I thought I was going to be the next New York Times, you know, newspaper writer. And at the time, newspapers was already starting their little decline. And I realized, I was like, well, this is it. You know, no more newspapers. What can I do? And I thought about magazine writing. And I just was not sure if that's the path that I wanted to go on. But then when I got to college, I started seeing other opportunities for writers. Because, you know, they always say you can't be what you can't see. And I didn't see anybody making a living writing other than writing for newspapers, or you was writing books. And I never thought at that time that I could write a book. So I just naturally went to the newspaper route. But then in college, I met people that were freelance writers. And I'm like, what do you mean? So I just write and I don't have to work for anybody. And I write an article and I get paid for it. Oh, wow. And then I had an opportunity. I left school because I had an opportunity to start freelance travel writing. And so I saved up a bunch of money and I went to Europe and updated guidebooks for a lot of these publishers. And that's one of the ways I first got started writing. And I got a chance to travel and see the world at the exact same time. And so I just kind of went into that. And so I was like, see, Mom, I can make money. Not a lot. Now, we're not talking about a lot of money. I mean, there was a lot of hostels, a lot of very questionable small hotels that I stayed into. But I was making some money and I was writing. And, you know, I was like, see, Mom, there are the ways. And then ever since then, when I realized that there are more ways than making money besides newspaper writing, I started exploring other ways, and such as grant writing and all this other stuff. But it was just stuff that I did not know whenever I was, you know, in sixth grade and coming up and after I graduated from high school.
So then when did you, after knowing that you could make a living writing and doing different things, even if it was for low pay, when did your brain say, you know what, I want to write a book now?
I had been freelance writing for about 10, 12 years by then. And I thought, what's the next step for me? I'm always trying to push and challenge myself to do something different. So I thought, what's the next step for me? And the next step for me was to write a book. So I said, okay, I'm going to write a book. I was working part-time at my local library and I was still freelancing. And I said, I'm going to write a book. And I did. It took me maybe a year or so to write it. And I thought, well, this is it. I can do it. I did it. I wrote a book. And then started the process of, as one does, of trying to actually get it published. And whew, that
what
that,
year was this?
2012. Yeah. And so I started the process of trying to find, you know, I started doing research on, okay, you got to get an agent. Then once you get an agent, get a book deal. And I thought, okay. You know, I thought I've been writing for such a long time. And I'm like, this, you know, this shouldn't be a hard thing. Whew. Yes, it was. I call that book my practice book. And I pitched that book for about 18 months. Mm-hmm. And I sent it out to over 100 agents, over 100 agents, and got some fantastic responses. Like, I got a bunch of full requests because at the time they were like, if you get a full request, that's a good thing. If you get a partial request, it's a good thing, you know, showing interest. So I got some of those. I even got a revise and resubmit. I thought, okay, we're really close now. Let me go work on it some more. None of it worked out. Mm. And I was so disappointed because, and the way I was raised and the way I think is you work really hard to something and there's a positive outcome at the end of it, right?
Yeah.
Like, I have worked on this book for all this time. I've been writing all this time. You know, like, at the end of this rainbow is supposed to be an agent and a book deal. Mm-hmm. And it didn't happen. And I did not know how to process that. And so I whined for years. I completely stopped writing. I said, I'm never writing another book again. I'm never writing another book. It's like, I'm not doing this again. Nope. I'm just going to continue to work at the library and I'm going to continue to freelance. And that's all I'm going to do. And I'm never going to do this again because it was very hard. It's very disheartening. Like, Oprah did not call me and tell me like my book was going to be a book club pick. You know, like, why didn't Oprah call? Like, I mean, I just, you know, of course, as a new writer, you start thinking all those great and wonderful things. It didn't happen, didn't work out. And I didn't know how to process it. I didn't have a circle of writing friends at the time to talk to about it. So I stopped writing books. I was like, I'm not going to do that again. I tried it and I'm not going to do it anymore. So I didn't. I took years off. As you can see, I took years off.
How many years did you take off?
Maybe about six or so before it started. The idea kind of replanted itself in my mind. But I took a long time off.
So then what was it that brought you back to the page? And was it one summer in Savannah?
It was. But it was also when you are called to do something, it doesn't go away because you say it does. I tell people that when you are called to be a writer, when you're called to be a pastor, when you're called to be something in life, it doesn't go away because you don't want to do it, right? It's still in you. I mean, I knew in the sixth grade that I was supposed to be a writer and I can run from it. And I was running from it. I can run from it all I want to, but it's going to keep getting put back in front of you. That desire, that burn doesn't go away because you want it to. And so it was there it started coming back up. Maybe you should try to write another book again, you know? And I don't like being complacent. And I found myself to be very complacent in my writing. I was moving up in my library world and I was doing freelancing. I was actually freelancing a lot less and working more at the library. But that seed was still there. So I said, okay, let's try this again. But I said, I went back and I thought about that first book and I thought, okay, I have to put this to rest that this book didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And I have to look at it in a positive manner. And I looked at it like I learned so much about publishing. I learned that as much as there's some great writers that will never be traditionally published just because that's just the way it works out. And I learned that there's a lot of, you know, luck that plays into publishing. I learned that you have to have the best agent, you know, because your agent just doesn't get this book deal for you. Your agent fights for you every step of the way and how important that is. I learned a lot about myself. I learned that, hey, you know, I have the discipline to write a book and to finish a book. And so I wanted to put that book in a good place. And then I said, okay, Tara, we're going to do this again. We're going to do it and we're going to do it right. And we're going to wait for an idea. I'm not going to force anything. I'm not going to make anything happen for myself. Inspiration is going to come. It's all going to come to me. It's going to be right. And so I started waiting and my ears was open where before I had closed my ears. So I opened my heart and my ears up to writing another book. And then that's when the inspiration started flooding in.
I hear the sermon on obedience coming out.
Yes.
So I wonder, so when you came back to the page with the idea for One Summer in Savannah, did you have the same type of verve and zest for writing that you did with the first novel, knowing that it could be another round of rejection and all of that kind of things that could almost block you from going further because you know what to expect in the experience?
Gosh, I did. Because of how One Summer in Savannah came together, I could not wait to write it. And so I thought, wow, I did not feel this way the first time I wrote that first book. This is different. And then of course that scared me because like you said, I was so afraid that am I going to write another book that no one's ever going to see? Mm. You know, but that I learned to just, I stifled that. And I was like, nope, we're not even going to go there. We're going to stay positive. We're going to just do this because we have to do this. And I'm a huge prayer. I ask God for guidance and helping me with everything. And the way it all came together, it was just letting me know that this was just his will. And So the first part of the inspiration came because my ears was open. And one other thing before I say about the inspiration is I'm a collection development librarian. My job is to buy all the adult print and digital materials for my library. So, you know, I read a lot and I've started noticing the stories that I was drawn to. I'm drawn to diverse, new and unique stories that I have not seen or have read before. And I love stories that when I'm thinking about a comparable to it, as you know, you have what are the comps to your book? I wanted to make it hard for people to find comps for my book. Like I wanted to set it apart and be different. And so I said, that's what I was drawn to. But then I listened to my patrons and they tell me the same thing. You know, they love their tried and true authors, you know, those authors, those automatic buy authors, they love those, but they're also hungry for those new and diverse and unique stories. And so I thought, okay, there's a market for this. You have to find the right book, the right idea, Tara. So I knew more about what I wanted to write. And then I also spent a lot of time working on my craft of writing itself. Mm. So I waited. I was like, I'm going to find this right inspiration. I'm going to wait and for God to lead me on what I'm supposed to do. And then the South Carolina church shooting happened. That completely polarized people. People were like, what? He went to a church and shot up a church after they fed him and prayed for him and welcomed him and accepted him. And he did that. And I just could not believe it. But even more not believing that, days after that happened, you know, those survivors and their family members, they walked into that courthouse and they forgave that man.
They did.
And I thought, okay, mom, church. I grew up in a church. Like, I don't, if y'all didn't tell me about this, like I knew forgiveness was always supposed to be on the table. But I don't think I ever defined what forgiveness was to me. Mm-hmm. And then over time, I just assumed that there were things that, you know what, if you didn't want to forgive, you didn't have to. Like forgiveness was up to you and you didn't have to do it. And I assumed that there were things that if it was so bad that you can choose not to forgive that. And they taught me opposite of that. They taught me, you know what, you can just forgive just about anything. And I thought, oh, my goodness. Oh my goodness. Okay. So that really challenged my definition of forgiveness. And mm-hmm. I said, okay, I have a theme. I want to write a book about forgiveness. I want to write a book that's going to really challenge people's definition of forgiveness the way mine was challenged. And so I thought, okay, I got a theme. And you know, you can't write a book without a story. So you can have a theme, but not a story. So I said, okay, I'm going to continue to wait. Okay, God is talking to me. It's coming. Let's keep waiting. And then a little bit after that, a very close friend of mine shared something with me that I did not know, that she had conceived a child through sexual assault. And she said these words, and I say this anytime I give any talks, because this is what I remember the most about our conversation, that she said, and I practice the act of forgiveness every day. Mm. And I thought, my goodness, there it is. Forgiveness tied to my theme. But the fact that she said that forgiveness is an act that she has to do every day. That also let me believe, no, I thought forgiveness, you just did it this one time and then it was done and it's over. No, forgiveness is a conscious effort that you do every day when you wake up. And I thought, oh goodness, this is it. Her story, that theme. And then I went and started doing research on conception after sexual assault and was just flabbergasted by the topic. And I thought, why are we not talking more about this? Like, this is an even darker side of sexual assault. And why are we not talking about this? And then I spoke to a couple of counselors about the topic. And I asked her, I said, is there the number of women that conceive children after sexual assault? And she says, Tara, if you find any number, double it. Wow. She said, because it's so vastly underreported. There's no true number for this. And then I started doing more research on the laws of this. I thought, well, okay, it's happening, but these laws are in place to protect these women. No, there is no federal law that takes away the parental rights from a man who conceived a child through sexual assault. No federal law at all. So that means it's left up to the states to decide, which, you know, 50 states, 50 different laws. And I discovered that some of these states barely have laws on the books for this at all. And I just could not believe that this is happening. And again, I feel like I'm a fairly educated. I'm a librarian. I do a lot of research. Why has this never come across me? How come I never knew about this? And I thought, okay, this is I'm going to write this. And I felt so passionate about bringing awareness to, you know, these women. And I went back to my friend and I asked her if I could share her story. And she was like, I assumed that she was. She was like, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. She said, there are so many Sarahs of the world. You know, Sarah, the main character of the book. There are so many Sarahs of the world. And, you know, you writing a book about it will definitely highlight, you know, our situation. And so then I had my book, which was ultimately turned out to be One Summer in Savannah.
Wow. I want to jump into the conversation about the book, but I want to get the publishing story, because mm-hmm. writing a book about forgiveness, I don't think I've ever seen that. Writing a book about conception after sexual assault, the only instance I can think of before is Law and Order SVU, because Olivia Benson's character was the child of a sexual assault. So mm-hmm. knowing that you had this story, I'm going to say it was a gift from God and your friend, and everything was conspiring in your favor. Mm-hmm. What was it like when you went out to approach agents and then publishers with this story that we haven't seen before in the marketplace and with Black characters?
Yes, yes. So my publishing story is different because I got my book deal before I got an agent. And so I'll get there. And so when I started sending it out, I thought, okay, people are going to want this. This is not something that is often found in fiction. Conception after sexual assault is not found in fiction. I found just one book in fiction, Christian fiction. And it tells a story of a woman who conceived a child after sexual assault. That's the only one I can find. And I'm a collection development librarian. I read hundreds of books a year. I have collection development friends. We put our heads together and we could not find anything. And so I knew, okay, this is different if a publisher is willing to go there with you, that mm-hmm. this is different. So I felt really good about the topic. And I started pitching in January of 2021. And started off right out the gate, full request. Like, I remember I did them in batches of 10. And the first 10 I sent out of those 6, I got full requests. And I thought, okay, we this is better than book one. You know, we're off to a great start. And then slowly it started being, oh, I don't know where I'm going to put this on the shelf. And, oh, the writing is great. The topic is great. It's just not for me. You know, those kind of, you know, rejections. And I thought, okay, that's fine. That first initial out the gate gave me confidence that, okay, maybe not you. I just got to find the right person. So I sent out 10 more, same thing, 4 and 5 full requests. And I got the most beautiful rejections. I mean, just beautiful. And that's what's so annoying about the whole process. It's like, you saying all this about the book, represent me, please. Like, I don't understand it. I do now, the importance of making sure you have an agent that, you know, really wants to represent your work. But then I was like, what are we doing? And so I pitched this book. This happened to me from January all the way up until November. So 11 months I was pitching this book. And I remember I was right at the end and I thought, I'm gonna have another book one. This book is gonna live on my hard drive. I was never gonna see the light of day again. And right before that, my editor had opened her submissions up to Black writers who didn't have agents. And, you know, it's very rare to be able to submit to an editor, you know, at a major publisher directly. So I took advantage and I sent it to her with no expectation because I've had 11 months of, hey, this is good and we like it, but, you know, at the end. And I sent it to her and I remember I was in my brother's kitchen making mashed potatoes right before Thanksgiving and I checked my email. I know I'm very specific with my
I love this.
And I got an email and I'd only sent her 50 pages. And I got an email from her and I thought, well, it's going to be, you know, sorry, but no. And she says, I am enraptured by these pages. She said, please send me the rest. And I showed it to my niece and she was like, all happy. And I was like, no, we're not getting happy. No, because 11 months of this, me being happy and then being disappointed. And so I sent it to her and I went on and continued living my life. And right before Christmas, she emailed me and said, I am crying and laughing at the same time. She said, I just finished your book. I'm crying and laughing at the same time. I love your book. Can we talk? And I thought, what happens here? Like,
this is an
editor. This is new. And so we talked. She told me everything she loved. She said, I'm taking it to acquisitions. And I thought, oh, there it is. That's the end of it. It's not going to make it out of acquisitions. I'm like, that's the end of it. Well, you know, it was a good ride. I felt good. You know, I felt really good. So she took it to acquisitions and she's supposed to call me like on that Wednesday and she didn't call. And I thought, yeah, there it is. Nope. So that's okay. My husband's like, okay, it's okay. You know, you got close. You can celebrate this, trying to find the positives in it. She called me that next day, Thursday, first thing that morning and was like, we have a deal. And not only a deal, we have a 2-book deal. Because in the process of talking to her about the first book, she asked me what I was working on and she loved that idea too. And then she says, okay, so now that you know, I want to offer you a book deal. You need to go get an agent. And I was like, oh, okay. Cause like, we can't negotiate and talk. And so I got the opportunity to approach agents and say, hey, I have a 2-book deal and I need an agent for it. There's still a lot of agents that had my full request. So I did the proper thing and let them know, hey, you're reading my full, I already have a book deal. But then I also asked my editor, Aaron, do you have any agents who you like to work with, you know, that I can talk to and recommend? And I end up going with one of the ones that she recommended to me. Her name is Abby Saul.
I love everything about this story, but I'm listening to you and I'm so excited of how it's unfolding and how it happened. But I even still hear your reserve and say, no, we're not getting excited about this. We're not getting excited about nothing. At any point with One Summer in Savannah or even the book prior, did you think about self-publishing because you were tired of waiting?
No. I admire anyone that self-publishes. My mother has written a couple of books that she just did not even try to traditionally publish. She just wanted to get them out there in the world. And it's a lot to self-publish to me. And I respect any writer that does that process. But I knew immediately that was not the path for me. And my dream was to be traditionally published with a publisher. And so I did not consider self-publishing.
All right. And so you have made that happen. One Summer in Savannah is here. So let's get into the book. Can you read a little bit from it so that I can ask you all of my questions about these
books? Yes.
One Summer in Savannah tells the story of Sarah Lancaster, who returns home to Savannah after 8 years with her daughter, Alana, a child she conceived after she was raped at a high school party. But even though everyone knew about the assault, no one knows about the child. It's a secret waiting to get out, especially when Sarah begins to fall for the twin brother of her attacker. Here's Tara.
I like this particular passage, and it's a Sarah section, and it's not the beginning. That's what everybody tends to really like, is that beginning part. But there's a passage that I really like. Sarah. I suppose I knew that eventually I would have to come back and face my past, but that level of awareness had never been where I could reach it. An invisible boundary has separated the girl who fled here 8 years ago and the woman I am today. With great care, I can find that girl, her memories, and the crimes committed against her. And now the moment I avoided has come around. With one phone call, suddenly, I'm back in that other country, which is burning bright as the morning sun. I was a vibrant teenager before it all. Nice at times, moody at others. I smiled at people and meant it. Looked them in the eye when I spoke to them. I laughed at everything. Tyler Robinson's corny jokes in Homeroom, ABC TGIF Friday sitcom lineup. I befriended the least popular and stood up to bullies. I valued holidays, Valentine's Day in particular, and as a way to celebrate individuals and relationships. I saved my money from working at the bookstore and bought everyone in my classes a Valentine. I personalized each one with my signature and a little heart above the A in my last name. Being back in Savannah plants me firmly in the middle of those memories, that time, being that girl again. But that's not who I am anymore. In Maine, the pain is as distant as a star. Trauma doesn't punch a clock, but you can set your watch by it. It works overtime most of the time, but it can be smothered like a whisper in a storm. That's what I do by living in Maine.
Thank you. So since you read a different section, I do want to start with that opening line, which is, It's difficult to pinpoint the moment I started loving my daughter. And so that's a hell of a way to open a book, because it's like, who doesn't love their child, or who doesn't lie at least and say that they love their child, right? And so to say, like, you know what, I didn't really love her in the beginning, is like, well, why? And as you begin to peel back and unfold the story, and I know it's based on your friend and what you had researched and all of that, and, you know, trying to find forgiveness, did you find that forgiveness had to begin with learning to love again?
For her, forgiveness was learning to accept what happened and understanding that she couldn't change it. And that first line, you know, I've had conversations with my friend and several other people who are in that same predicament. And one of the things they talked about was how the love just kind of came later. And I remember, I mean, I have received several emails from women that said, you know, I'm not a Sarah, but the love for my child came later because I was in an abusive relationship or the circumstances of their birth was tough. And, you know, we live in a society where, you know, society tells us that the minute we find out we're pregnant, we're supposed to be happy and excited about it, which, you know, children are a blessing. They are a blessing, but we have to understand that not everybody's circumstances are the same and that there are a lot of issues that they're having to deal with, you know, and being pregnant at the same time, not to mention the hormones that come along with being pregnant. And that's one of the things that I wanted to infuse into the book, is something that she told me was, you know, I was so confused about this conception. And, you know, that love did not materialize at first. And then later on, and this happens in the book, and I don't want to spoil it, Sarah said that she didn't love her at first, but she was going to protect her. And that protection was love. Love manifests itself in so many different reasons. And so where Sarah thought that she didn't love and had that, you know, that outbursting of love for her daughter, she did. She said, the first thing I did, I'll protect her. Protection is love. That's the way she could love her at first, rather than that explosion of love that, you know, society expects us to have.
Did you always know that the villain in the story and the love interest would be twins? Because I just thought that was cruel and unusual punishment. I was like, the love interest and the guy are twins?
Twins. I did. Okay. So everything, you know, I took my time writing this book And everything in this book was intentional. And there's a lot of symbolism and there's a lot of parallels in this story. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. one of the things that I wanted to show was, again, something that I've heard several people say, and especially my friend say, she says, when I had to come home and face this, I had to literally face my past. And I thought, how can I infuse that? How can I put that in the book? And I thought, why not have Jacob be an identical twin? Because it's literally her facing her past in order to understand and accept, you know, what happened to her. And so, because this is the question I'm asked the most, like, why did you make Jacob an identical twin brother?
Yes. So I'm like, I don't know how she got past it. And like, I know it's about forgiveness and you did the work for us, but I'm like, I'm not getting past the face.
I know a lot of people are like, I can't get it. My husband is a twin. He's not an identical twin. He's a fraternal twin. And one of the things, and I've heard from several people that are twins, was I'm not like my twin. You can look exactly like somebody and not still be that same person. And Jacob from the beginning says, I am not my brother. And he is completely opposite from Daniel. They're not the same person. And, you know, circumstances has changed the way Daniel looks. Right. But it's more of a symbolic thing that I wanted readers to kind of come along with me. Like, she had to literally face her past.
And not only did she have to face her past, everybody's got a past to face in this book. So mm-hmm. Jacob, once he finally sees Alana, has to face his own past.
Right.
And so in talking about forgiveness, it's also talking about grief. Grief mm-hmm. from the things that you lose and grief from the mm-hmm. things that are stolen from you.
Yes.
Why was that the trajectory that you ended up going down and saying that, you know, you have to grieve and let things go. And then you also have to forgive so that right. you can move on.
That's right. Well, because at first this was just going to be a Sarah story. There was mm-hmm. not going to be a dual POV. It was going to be Sarah's story. And that was it. And I'm not sure about you. I hear voices. My characters speak to me when I write. And so this character of Jacob was very strong. And I thought, all this stuff you're telling me, Jacob, I can't use any of this because it's all going to be either backstory or info dumping. And I can't use any of it. And then I wrote and I got to a point in Sarah's story where I felt like I hit the wall. I'm like, where am I going with this? I'm a pantser, by the way. I make it up as I go. I know the end. But I don't know anything in the middle as I'm, it's coming to me as it goes. And so I hit the wall, as pantsers a lot of times do. And I thought, where am I going? What's happening? And then that's when I realized that Jacob has his own story to tell, right? Like, Jacob can offer a unique perspective to Sarah's story that would not have been in a single Sarah POV. Because we have a Jacob POV, we hear directly from Daniel. We hear directly from Birdie. And so I realized, okay, Jacob needs to have a voice, but what is his story? And his story was, he has his own forgiveness to seek and to give. And so where she's dealing with forgiveness, he's dealing with forgiveness, but grief plays into it. Mm-hmm. And grief and a forgiveness, sometimes they, you know, they kind of align in there together. And it was, you know, they never grieved. They never learned how to grieve. And like, what is his issues with his family? And so Jacob kind of has his own story where Sarah has her own story. And then, you know, of course, they all kind of intersect. But that's why I ended up going with the grief for their side of the story, just because he needed his own path.
Okay. Yeah. Their mother about sent me. I was so overwhelmed. I was like, ma'am, you are working my last nerve. You don't go somewhere, sat down.
yes.
Somewhere. But I feel like one of the most intriguing characters is Sarah's father.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking only in poems. First of all, I see your library collections at work because you know that work. But then having people be able to translate what those poems mean to get to the heart of what he was saying or what he was feeling or refusing to say, but feeling rather. Why and where did that come from?
Okay, I love this question. Hosea is loosely based on my grandfather, who suffered a stroke whenever I was 12 years old, and he lost his ability to speak. So for the rest of his life, we had to decipher what he was trying to tell us through gestures, through sounds. And so I thought, I'm going to honor my grandfather. I'm going to make him Sarah's father, but I need Sarah's father to speak words. Like, he needs to have, you know, dialogue. I thought, how can I do that? And when I went back to school, I majored in English. I changed it from journalism to English, and I studied a lot of poetry. You know, I have several English degrees, and poetry is always that, you know, one of those classes you have to take, but I am drawn to poetry. So I always loved it. So I thought, why not poetry? And poetry is also, I feel like, a dying art. I feel like it's a dying form of communication that we need to try to embrace a little bit more than what we do. So I thought, why not poetry? You know, why not use poetry? When you read a poem, a lot of times you have to read it multiple times in order to decipher the meaning. So I thought, why not do that? And originally he was only going to speak, you know, some of his dialogue in poetry. And I remember letting an early, you know, early reader read it. And I thought, she thought, just go all in on it. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to go all in on this and just see what happens. And I said, oh, if an agent or publisher tells me to change it, I'll change it. They never did. Everybody loved it. And I thought, you know what? We're going to do this. And then people say, was it really hard to come up with the poems? No, for several reasons. One, I use my favorite poems. There's a lot of Yeats, a lot of Whitman, a lot of Paul Laurence Dunbar, who are my favorites. So a lot of those, you know, just like people know song lyrics, I know poems. So they're in my head. So it wasn't too hard for me.
What has been the response now that the book is out and people are being able to read this entire story that you that mm-hmm. came together over years mm-hmm. about forgiveness, about grief, about conception after sexual assault? How have readers responded to you and your story?
Tell you, I wrote this book and I did not have any expectations on this time. I didn't expect Oprah to call me. You know, I didn't have that. It's just like, you know what? I did it. And I wanted people to be able to read it, but I wasn't trying to dictate, you know, if it was going to be a New York Times bestseller or whatever. So I just put the book out there and the response has been unbelievable to me. Mm. I found out in January, the book came out July 4th. I found out in January that Target wanted to make it the July book club pick. And Target, if you know a little bit about their book club, they select those diverse, unique stories, the same thing, go all the way back to where I said, if I was going to write something, I was going to do something that's going to be different. They feature those stories. And I thought, this is full circle for me. This is full complete circle. And I knew by having it just in Target that it was going to expand the readership even more. I found out very early on that One Summer's Event is going to be a lead title for my publisher. So they have really backed me. So I figured that would be enough. But then Target has really expanded. I have heard from a bunch of Sarahs that have emailed me and said, thank you so much for, you know, highlighting and bringing awareness to us. I've heard from people whose fathers or cousins or mothers stopped speaking traditionally or had a different way of speech. I did not anticipate, you know, to hear from all these different people about different situations. I heard from women who said that, you know, thank you for that first paragraph in your book about women not immediately loving their children, you know, due to circumstances beyond their control. I just recently talked to an Alana, a woman who was the product of a sexual assault. And she said that, you know, I've never read a book about someone like me. And that has been the most positive, you know, reception to me. I mean, the book is selling well, and I'm very blessed for that. But what I am more proud of is that it's touching people and they're loving it and they're seeing themselves in it. Mm-hmm. You know, where go all the way back when I was in the sixth grade and I wanted to think about making a career in writing, but I didn't see any different paths, you know, to that. People are seeing themselves in this book. And that has been the most positive, you know, thing for me.
Congratulations. So I want to switch to a speed round in the game before I let you go for what's soon to be the afternoon. What is your favorite book?
Oh, you cannot ask a librarian their favorite book.
Okay, top five.
As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner, Everything I Never Told You by Celeste Ng, The Vanishing Half by Brett Bennett, Cold Millions by Jess Walter. And let's leave it at four because I can't think of that. I can't think of another one.
Okay. Who is your favorite author?
I'm going to have to give you a couple because I can't pick one. Brett Bennett, Celeste Ng, right out. I mean, contemporary that's publishing, that's still alive, that's publishing now. I'm a William Faulkner fan. I know that may not be popular, but, you know, I studied a lot of that in English. But I have been really loving Sean Cosby's books. You know, I just finished All the Sinners Bleed and I'm just really baffled by what he's been able to do.
Who is your favorite poet?
Oh, Yeats. No question. And then I love Mary Oliver. I guess there'd be two. So Mary Oliver and Yeats are probably my favorites.
And you mentioned how you said that poetry is like people are getting away from it. I don't want to call it a dying art form because I don't think that it is. But I think people are getting away from it. And because spoken word is being lionized in a way that traditional poetry isn't. So in that vein, what do you think is the difference, if you think there is one, between poetry and spoken word?
I don't think there is a difference. I think that it's all in how it's delivered and how it's written and where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And it's just a different way of communicating. And, you know, where people said, I've heard from people say, I don't really like poetry. So I skipped over the Hosea part. And but it's the same as him speaking words. It's just different. So I guess that's it. Poetry is just more of a different way of communicating versus spoken word.
If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
If money was no object, I would be in Paris. I'd be writing in Paris and I'd be living in Paris. Paris is my favorite. It's my favorite place. It's the place where I've been the most. As a matter of fact, I've started when I finish a book, I go to Paris. So when I finished my second book, I went to Paris. The book I'm writing now, I've already booked my ticket. So to kind of force myself to finish by February, I'm going to Paris. So Paris is the place where I always just keep going back to.
So I already bought my ticket. So
yes. So we got to finish this book by February because we're going.
We're going to Paris. I love that. Mm-hmm. Name three things on your bucket list.
To be a New York Times bestselling author. To start an endowment for my library or for a library in need. Libraries is just, you know, it's been really hard lately to be a librarian with all the banned book conversations and stuff that's happening. So it's been really hard. And there are libraries that are losing their funding because of this banned book issue. And I'd love to start something that would help them be able to stay current. And what would be another thing? I guess to retire and be able to just write full time. That's what I'm really hoping to do soon.
Name an author you most admire.
I'm going to go with Celeste Ng. I admire her style of writing. Before Everything I Never Told You was her first book, was her debut novel. And I remember reading that and thinking, I love this style. I love this style. And that's the style that I wanted to gravitate toward. Lyrical. Mm-hmm. You know, her and Brett Bennett both have this lyrical way. I remember reading The Vanishing Half and I thought, I'll never be able to write as good as this. The way she told that story and the lyrical tone to that book, I thought, this is the type of writing that I want to do. And they have just consistent, both of them. And that's why they will always be my favorite, because that's the style of type of writing that I'm drawn to. And I admire them for being able to do that.
Thank you. The game is called Rewriting the Classics. Name one book you wish you would have written.
As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner, which I tried. My second book is very much kind of influenced by that book. But that's one of the books I was like, man, I wish I wrote a classic. Man, I wish I wrote that. That's my classic one. I have a contemporary one that I wish I wrote too.
What is it? I'm curious.
Water for Elephants by Sarah Gruen. I love that book. And it's rare that I say that, you know, I wish I wrote a book. Most of the time I enjoy them, but I'm like, man, I wish I wrote that book. But of course I'd make it black.
Name one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
I think I'd probably have to say Daisy Jones and the Six. I love that book so much. The end of that book frustrated me. I just wish they would have got together right at the end and not this whole, all this time separated and went by. I'm like, what? You know, you slow burn this whole thing and then we still don't get that gratification the payoff at the end. And so I would definitely change the end of that.
All right. And then I know you may not say this as a librarian, but I'm going to ask anyway.
Yeah.
Name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught and why.
A book. You are putting me on the spot here. I'm going to do an author. And I actually have one of her books here. And it's not her as the writing, I think. It's the way her books are being pushed. I feel like Emily Henry's books are not romance. I feel like they are women's fiction with a romance in them. And it's confusing for me. I mean, it has a happily ever after, which, you know, all the things that, you know, romance is supposed to be. But when I read her books, I don't see romance in it. I see women's fiction, which I don't even like the term women's fiction because, you know, there's no men's fiction. So I hate that term, but that term still exists. So that's the term that I know. And I don't feel like they're, I don't feel like they're romance. And so I think her books are, you know, miscategorized.
That was very dignified.
Yes, because I enjoy her books, you know, and I know millions of people. She is uber popular. Millions of people enjoy her books. So this is not a knock on her or anything. I just feel like they're not, you know, that they're not romance.
Okay. And my final question for you today. Mm-hmm. When you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of words and work that you've left behind?
That I brought awareness to these little known circumstances that happen to people, that they learned from reading, you know, my fiction books. They learned about real life circumstances from reading my fiction books. You know, that's kind of going to be what my niche is. My books are going to be based on circumstances happen to real life people that society just doesn't talk about enough. And I want people to be able to say, you know, because I read a Tara Shelton Harris book, you know, I realized that there's a darker side of sexual assault, that there's a thing, it's conception after sexual assault. In my second book, I want people to be able to say, you know, I know more about air property and land and ancestral land than, you know, than I ever did, you know, and stuff like that. Like, I want people to remember me from bringing that awareness to these circumstances.
Big thank you to Tara Shelton Harris for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Tara's debut novel, One Summer in Savannah, out now from Sourcebooks Landmark. And if you're not following Tara, check her out on the socials. She's at Tara S. Harris, and Tara's T-E-R-A-H. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's B-L-K and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Tara about the effects of book bans on libraries. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Donovan X. Ramsey, author of When Crack Was King, A People's History of a Misunderstood Era.
You know, Black people in America, we experience the highest highs and the lowest lows. That if you want to understand the American story, that you got to look at the Black American story. And that all of America, everything that's ever happened, is in our story. So I can't help but find the humanity in Black folks when I tell our stories. That I can't help but to look for the moments of humor in tragedy.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.